electrical and thermal conductivity. It turns out that getting from band structure to transport is not so easy. And in my full semester course that I give on UBC, I would now go on to about 3 lectures explaining this transport theory. But I don't want to do it here. I was asked to do maybe some more modern things, and I will do that next week. But still, this series of lectures would be incomplete if I completely omitted transport. So what I will do, I will just condense all this material to one lecture where I will outline the basic ideas behind this and show you some main results, but I will not do the derivation. If you're interested, this is done in great detail in Ashcroft and Merman. Basically, chapters 12 and 13 discuss this topic in a great detail, and you're welcome to peruse it. It's no rocket science, but it's kind of a technical in places. So I want to skip those things. Now, before I go on, there's one thing that I forgot to mention last time, which is kind of important. And this is a concept of effective mass in the context of this tight binding model and more generally. So let me just quickly say what that is. So basically, when you have an electron dispersion, such as the one we derived last time from the tight binding model, this cosine dispersion, you can see that near the very bottom of the band and near the very top of the band, the dispersion looks locally parabolic. So when the electron is in this vicinity or here, it looks more or less like a free particle. And therefore, one can associate mass with this band. And let me just quickly show you how to do that. Well, basically, one can just expand this energy dispersion near the bottom of the band and near the top of the band. So for instance, near k equals 0, one can expand epsilon k to leading order. And what happens is the following. So I'm just expanding this cosine to Taylor series near 0, and the leading term dependent on momenta is this. And I can just write this, if I want to, as h bar squared k squared over 2m star, where m star is now the effective mass. And just by comparing the two coefficients, I can deduce that the effective mass is the following. So this is the effective mass. Indeed, if I have electrons once again near the bottom of the band, I can do useful calculations in this approximation instead of using this cosine band. Now, one thing to note here is that this effective mass m star of the electron near the bottom of the band has absolutely nothing to do with electron bare mass, right? The actual electron mass doesn't even enter this expression. It simply depends on lattice constant, Planck constant, and T, which is this overlap integral between the wave functions, and electron mass doesn't enter there. So in principle, this can be very large or very small compared to the electron mass. And it purely depends on the property of the solid in a tight binding approximation. Similarly, one can do this expansion near k equals pi over a, pi over a point, which is the maximum in the band, in which case one obtains a similar expression. However, one obtains an expression like this, E naught, in this case, plus 4t. And then there's a minus sign because I'm expanding near the maximum, so my curvature is downwards. And in this case, it turns out that the effective mass is even negative, right? So in this case, m star is minus h bar squared over 2t a squared. And again, this is just a property of a solid. It has nothing to do with the actual mass of the electron, which you can see here. It's negative, so clearly it cannot be related to real mass of the electron. And this negative mass has to do with this funny fact that we discussed last time, that when you push on the electron, you add momentum to it, it actually slows down, right? So that's the, in other words, it has negative mass near the top of the band. Any questions about that?
You can call that a hole mass, right?
Yeah, yeah. We have not introduced holes yet, which we will do briefly in a moment, but yeah.
Do you write it as a positive or negative?
Let's just wait until we get there, and that's going to be more transparent, hopefully. Yes?
Do you define an effective mass along everywhere along the curve, or just at the terminal?
You can define usefully effective mass near the maxima and minima of this band dispersion, right? In principle, that's where one should define it. Because only there you have parabolic dispersion, right? If near some general point, you also have a linear term if you were to expand. And so, mass is not that useful a concept at that point. Okay, let's start with the transport discussion. Let me just say that it is possible to develop a fully quantum mechanical theory of transport in solids. But for this, we would need all the formalism of Green's functions and Kubo formulas and all that, which we have not developed in this course. So the formalism of choice is semi-classical theory, which is actually very useful because it leads important insights into this problem. So this is based on the semi-classical approximation in quantum mechanics. Also known as WKBJ approximation. And what you hopefully have seen before in either undergraduate or graduate quantum mechanics is this WKBJ approximation, which basically says that when you write a wave function for a wave packet, something like this, sum over k prime g k prime e to I k prime dot r minus h bar squared. Sorry, this is just h k prime squared over 2m times t, where this gk prime is some smooth function in momentum space, and this describes a wave packet. One can show that the center of mass, so to speak, of this wave packet behaves classically. So one can associate a coordinate and momentum with this. So WKBJ says that you have some wave packet with some smooth envelope, and if we associate the position and momentum with this wave packet, which we now can as long as we stay within the limits of the uncertainty principle, then these behave according to basically classical equations of motion, h bar k over m, and h bar k dot, if there are forces caused by electric and magnetic fields, which we will be interested in. So these are the semi-classical equations of motion. And these are just, this is just the second Newton's law, right? This first one relates the derivative of the coordinate of the position to particle momentum. And the second one says that the change in momentum is equal to the force acting on the particle, where I forgot electron charge. We're assuming, since we're interested in charged particles, that these forces are electromagnetic in nature. So the first, well, it's just a Lorentz force acting on a charged particle with velocity v. So what we would like to do is to adapt this formulation for particles moving in a periodic potential. Okay? Instead of a particle moving in free space subject to these slowly varying electric and magnetic fields, we want to adapt it to an electron moving in a crystal, which is also subject to applied electric and magnetic fields. And it turns out that the mathematics behind this, deriving similar semi-classical equations of motion, is not trivial. But nevertheless, one can obtain precisely the same form of semi-classical equations of motion. So in the crystal, one can construct a wave packet that looks like this. For each band, again, sum over k prime, the same function gk prime, that is basically the envelope of the wave packet in the momentum space. And then one constructs these wave functions from the Bloch eigenstates that are the eigenstates of the electron in the solid. And here in the exponential, instead of just a free electron energy, there's a band energy epsilon nk prime that one obtains by solving the Bloch equation for a particle in a given potential. Okay, so for this type of wave packet, one can then go ahead and show that similar semi-classical equations of motion apply. The only difference here is that, same equations of motion apply, except velocity will be given by 1 over h bar . So instead of the first equation, which says that the velocity is just h bar k over m, we will have an equation that r dot is equal to a band velocity, which in general can be a more complicated function of k. However, the second equation of motion remains the same. Okay. So basically, the equation looks like this. R dot is equal to that, and the second equation of motion remains the same. So let me just copy it here. H bar k dot is minus E electric field plus 1 over C. And now instead of velocity, that is just a constant, we write the band velocity So once again, in the case of a free particle, these equations of motion are relatively easy to derive, and hopefully everybody has seen that in quantum. In the case where you have a periodic potential, this is much more tricky, but nevertheless, these equations can be shown to be valid. And they are subject to certain limitations. And they can be summarized like this. Basically, one needs these applied fields, E and H, to be weak enough for these equations to be satisfied. So E times E times A has to be much smaller than delta K squared divided by the Fermi energy. Delta K is the band gap. And similarly, H bar omega C has to be much smaller than the same thing, delta K squared over epsilon F. This gives a condition on magnetic field. Omega C is the classical cyclotron frequency, EB over M star C, where M star is the effective mass in a given band, so this is cyclotron frequency. And there is one additional condition which is imposed on when these fields E and H are AC fields at certain frequency. Omega, this omega must also be much smaller than delta of K. So basically what these conditions tell you is that in order for these semi-classical equations of motion to be valid, the electron has to stay in a given band, right? If the electric fields are too large or they vary too rapidly, then they can give electron enough energy to undergo a transition between two bands. So basically, you have two bands. And as we will see, these equations of motion just describe electron as a function of time, basically moving in a certain way in this band. But if there is enough energy available, then the electron can make a transition to a higher band, and this would be a discontinuity from the point of view of these equations, and they would not be valid. So as long as these equations are satisfied, then everything is fine, and these transitions do not occur. Yes?
So these equations then don't work for metals because the band, they don't have a band gap?
They work for metals, but as long as how should I say this? So whenever there are band gaps, right? If there are no band gaps, then this doesn't really come in, right? That's the right answer to that question. So whenever there are band gaps in a crystal, so that transitions between bands are possible, then these must be satisfied. If there's no band gaps, then of course the electron just moves in the band and nothing really happens. Now in practice, these two conditions for electric field and frequency are typically well satisfied for all laboratory fields. It's almost impossible to apply electric field large enough to violate this except in a very narrow band gap semiconductors. However, the second condition for magnetic field is actually relatively easy to violate. So when one applies field of a few tesla to a narrow band gap semiconductor, very easily one can cause these transitions, and that's called magnetic breakdown. But again, maybe this is not super important at this level of discussion. Okay, so the semi-classical theory of transport basically answers two questions, or breaks down this question of transport in solids into two sub-questions. One, let me first say the following. Basically, the picture is the following. In an ideal solid with no imperfections, electrons then simply move in a very good approximation following these semi-classical equations of motion. And the important concept is dissipation. So under these equations, everything is conserved. Energy and momentum cannot dissipate. So an important ingredient in transport theory is relaxation. And this occurs because of various imperfections in a solid. So the theory of transport basically consists of two questions. One is, what is the nature of relaxation in the solid? What is the imperfections that cause scattering between states? And then, how do electrons behave between these scattering effects, between these scattering events? And the semi-classical equations of motion answer the first part of the question. Electrons follow the semi-classical equations of motion between collisions. And then we still have to answer the question, how do collisions affect this behavior? So how do electrons move between collisions? And second, what is the effect of collisions on electron transport? And we now answer these two questions in this order. So we already wrote down semi-classical equations of motion, so we can now study them to answer this question number one. And once we've learned a little bit about this, then we can turn to this second equation of motion, the second question. So let's just first discuss some of the consequences of these semi-classical equations of motion, which will be of interest. And one important consequence is the following. Filled bands are inert as far as transport is considered. And this is irrespective of this second part of the question. And that's why we're addressing it right now. So when you have a completely filled band, or completely empty band for that matter, but that kind of seems obvious. It seems obvious that when you have a completely empty band, it cannot contribute to transport because it contains no electrons. However, it's perhaps not completely obvious that when you have completely filled band, that it also does not contribute to any transport. So let's discuss this here. Let's write an expression for the electric current. And we had this expression before. Let me just copy it. It's an integral d3k over 4 pi cubed of the velocity. Okay, now normally this would be 8 pi cubed, but I'm now taking into account the effect of spin. Okay, so each state in a band is occupied by spin up and spin down. This is an integral over all occupied states. But I'm going to discuss the situation when the band is completely filled. And the way to do this is to substitute from the equation of motion 1 over h bar d epsilon k over dk. And now for filled band, I have integral over the full Brillouin zone, right? But the point is that epsilon k is a function that is periodic on the Brillouin zone. For instance, the cosine function that we had in tight binding model is an example of that. And we have argued on general grounds from Bloch theorem that this is the case. So what one has here is an integral when the band is filled over one period of periodicity of a derivative of a periodic function, and this integral necessarily vanishes. So this integral over the full Brillouin zone is necessarily zero, and there's just a mathematical theorem. If you don't see that, well, let's just do that in one dimension, one-dimensional example. So in this case, we will have J minus E integral just dk from minus pi over A to pi over A of 1 over h bar d epsilon k dk. And maybe I have pi here. This epsilon k is a periodic function on this interval, so I can immediately integrate, and what I will get is minus e over pi h bar, and then the integral is simply epsilon k from minus pi over a to pi over a, but since this function is periodic, these two values are exactly the same, and this is going to be zero. And with just a little more effort, one could prove this in three dimensions, but I think this statement is obvious. So indeed, filled bands are inert, and they do not contribute to the current. And basically, this is because of the argument that I presented yesterday. In a filled band, you always have the same number of electrons moving left as you have right, and no matter how you rearrange them, this is always true because all the states are already filled. So, in fact, you cannot really rearrange that meaningfully in any way. Okay, so second point that I would like to make before moving on to collisions is the simplest case when one can solve these semi-classical equations of motion, which is in motion in applied DC electric field. In other words, we take H equals zero and E is a constant. So in that case, the second equation of motion can be immediately solved, right? I just have h bar k dot is minus e times capital E, where capital E is just a constant. And the solution is simply the following: k of t is k of 0 minus e divided by h bar times t. So semi-classical equations of motion in the case of uniform electric field, which is a kind of case of greatest interest, because when you want to calculate, say, a conductivity of a metal, you would apply such a uniform DC field. They tell us that momenta of all electrons simply start evolving linearly in time with this as a coefficient describing that linear dependence. Okay, so what this means is that, again, let's take a 1D example of a cosine band, which is partially filled at the beginning. So here's my momentum, k, epsilon k. And let's suppose my chemical potential initially is here. So all these states are filled before I apply the electric field. It's a metal. I now apply electric field in this direction. So this is my electric field E. Now, because of the fact that the electric charge is negative, then momenta of these electrons will start marching in the opposite direction. So at some later time, t, I will find that these states are occupied like so, from here to there, okay, at some time t greater than 0. And as the time progresses, basically this whole train of electrons just keeps going and eventually emerges on the other side of the Brillouin zone, because everything is periodic. So this is a kind of interesting finding that this simple solution gives us, and kind of counterintuitive, right? So imagine what this does. As soon as you break the equilibrium, namely as soon as you move this distribution by this electric field, you generate current, right? For this red distribution, there's more electrons moving that way than that way, so this will be a state with non-vanishing current. So here, J will be non-zero. However, something stranger happens. So you expect, okay, I applied electric field, it's a metal, so I should get some current. However, you can see that this current will be strangely periodic in time, because after some time, capital T, this train of electrons will go all the way around and come back to the original ground state, and there will be no current, right? So this is counterintuitive. So this produces current that is periodic in time. And let me put two exclamation marks and question mark behind that, because this is decidedly not what we normally would expect. When we apply electric field to a metal, we expect a steady current, not something that oscillates in time with large amplitude. So what went wrong? Well, of course, what went wrong is that we didn't take into account this second aspect, namely, what is the effect of collisions? And in any sort of real metal that we would measure, there is impurities, disorder, that will tend to restore equilibrium. And what will happen in a real metal is that at the same time as this is happening, there will be processes in which electrons from these high energy states will be brought back to where they belong. So this is collisions. And in fact, equilibrium will be restored by balancing the effect of electric field and collision. So the more electric field you apply, the more out of equilibrium you can drive the system. But at some point, there will always be sufficient number of collisions that will restore equilibrium. So in fact, collisions restore steady state. Now, that happens typically. Let me write this another note. However, there exists phenomenon that is called Bloch oscillations. Namely, if you really try extremely hard experimentally in making as clean a sample as you can make, and you cool it down to extremely low temperatures so that lattice vibrations don't result in these collisions, then it turns out, in fact, you can see this type of oscillatory behavior in extremely pure metals. This is this has been shown only, relatively recently, within the last 10 years or so, when you take absolutely pure samples of gold, which you then purify and crystallize in extremely painful ways, then you cool them down to cryogenic temperatures and you measure electric transport, then in fact you can see signature of these Bloch oscillations. So you apply electric field and indeed this type of phenomenon seems to occur. So this this confirms the validity of these semi-classical equations of motion, but this only happens in extremely pure samples at ultra-low temperatures. Okay. Normally, in vast majority of cases, all you would see is just Ohm's law here. Okay. One interesting consequence of this is theory of holes, which we already brought up. So you see this current. So imagine I have a situation when I have a band that is nearly filled. Okay, what I can do, I can rewrite this expression for the current, which involves integral over all occupied states, to an integral of all states minus those that are unoccupied. And since integral over all states is zero, as we just showed, I can express the current in terms of just states that that are unoccupied. And let me just do that quickly. So J, writing this schematically, is minus E times integral of something over occupied states, right? And I can rewrite this as minus E times integral over all states minus K is empty. Right? That's an identity. However, we show that this guy here is zero. That's just the fact that filled bands are irrelevant. So I can write the current as a current of plus E integral d3k, and let me now write the full expression here, pi cubed 1 over h bar d epsilon k over dk, and this is k, importantly, is all over all empty states. So if I write it like this, it turns out I can equally well attribute the current in a band to all the empty states here. So these, in this case, these are empty states, right? But I have to attribute to them a positive charge plus E. And this is the concept of holes, right? So in a band like this, it turns out one can view the current as contributed by negatively charged electrons, and equally well, one can integrate over the empty portion of the band and put a positive charge in front, and they are equally real, right? Those are these equations, that's a mathematical identity. So this is one of those things. Of course, such a hole has really no existence outside the solid. That's why we tend to view it less as being less real than electron, which we can actually take out of the solid. But inside the solid, there's really no fundamental difference between describing a current as being carried by a negatively charged electron or a positively charged hole. Now, in practice, the way this is useful is when you have a nearly filled band, right, that almost all states are filled, then it's actually easier to calculate the current by integrating over just a small portion of the band that is unoccupied. So typically, when you have a band that is less than half filled, you would need a language of you would use a language of electrons. If you have a band that is kind of almost filled, you would use a language of holes. And this then leads to theory of N and P-type semiconductors. In one, electrons are dominant carriers, in the other, holes are, and so on and so forth. Okay, any questions about this? So let me say a few words about motion in magnetic fields. So we discussed motion of electric fields, and we will continue with this discussion when we add collisions in a moment. But as a brief digression, let me say a few words about what happens when you have only magnetic fields, because this also leads to an important suite of experiments in condensed matter physics. So magnetic field, so I take now E to be 0, but H to be non-zero, just a constant field. And there's one simple statement that one can make, which then underlies this motion, in fact, determines it completely. And the statement goes like this. The vector, the component of momentum parallel to magnetic field, and epsilon k are constants of motion. And maybe surprisingly, these two constants of motion completely determine all the trajectories that you can have. Now, this is not surprising classically, right? We know that when a charged particle moves in magnetic field, it experiences Lorentz force that is always perpendicular to its motion. Therefore, a component of its momentum along the magnetic field is always conserved because the force is always perpendicular, right? And similarly, the energy of that particle is conserved because the force is always perpendicular to its motion. It's maybe less obvious in this band theory, but one can easily show that this is the case. So let me go through a proof. This k is k parallel is basically this. I take a unit vector in the direction of field, and then I project the momentum onto the field direction. That's how I can define this k parallel. And h with a hat is just h divided by the length. So it's a unit vector along the field. And what I can do, I can take the second equation of motion, which is this one. So I take this equation of motion and I dot it into the magnetic field vector. And let's see what I get. So the left-hand side of H dotted into K dot is minus E over H bar C, H dotted into V cross H, right? So again, I'm just taking that second equation of motion, Newton's law, and dotting it into H dot. And I see that the right-hand side is zero because, of course, V cross H will be perpendicular to H. And then when I dot it into H, this is zero. So this is the same as to say that K dot parallel is zero, which is just to say that K parallel is an equation of motion. And similarly, one can show, so similarly, one can show that d epsilon k dt is zero, which would simply show that epsilon k is also a constant of motion. Now, as a result, then electrons move along curves given by intersections of surfaces of constant energy with planes perpendicular to H. Epsilon k. With planes perpendicular to magnetic field H. Okay? I hope I can show some slides next time because this is kind of difficult to draw on the blackboard, but let's suppose constants of energy are spheres. Right, like you would have in just free electrons. This is my epsilon k is equal to constant, right? And now I apply magnetic field like this. Then what this tells me is that the electron, when it's already at this surface of a constant energy, will move now a response to this magnetic field along a line that is an intersection of the sphere with a plane that is perpendicular to the magnetic field. So let's say I have an electron here, and then I cut a line through the sphere, and I find that it will move like so. And the direction depends on the right-hand rule, whether I apply the field this way or that way, it will move like that or in the opposite direction. And it will come back on the other side of the sphere like that. If the electron is, for instance, here, then it will move like so, and so forth. So basically, one gets these trajectories that encircle surfaces of constant energy. And this leads to a very powerful probe of the energy spectrum in a solid that goes under the name of magnetic oscillations, or sometimes are called the Haas von Alphen oscillations. And this is a kind of classic way to probe experimentally the surface of constant energy in a metal by subjecting it to magnetic field and measuring some quantity. And one finds that pretty much all measurable quantities in a metal then oscillate with magnetic field, and the period of oscillation has to do with the area covered by these contours. So one can, by careful experimentation, back out the surface of constant energy in a metal, namely the Fermi surface, for instance. And that was the kind of original way of understanding the energy dispersions in materials. Any questions about this? Okay, so let me now move to this second question. What is the effect of collisions, namely how does energy and momentum dissipate in solids? So electrons, so this is part two of while we're answering the second question. Electrons in solids undergo collisions. And one may first ask, what is the source of these collisions? And there are several things that come to mind. So individual ions forming a periodic lattice. And this is the idea of Drude, who first developed a classical theory of conductivity known as Drude theory. Then electrons can perhaps scatter off of other electrons. There's many of them there. Then there is disorder. Crystal defects. Impurities. Which I always present in a crystal. And then finally, phonons, or lattice vibrations. And there could be others, maybe magnons, but those are not as strong. So when we look at that list, we have to actually exclude one. So it turns out that this first, although the original discussion, the Drude theory, was quite successful. Drude assumed that ions would be the dominant scatterer in a metal. This is actually wrong, and I have to write this in a large letter so that nobody can accuse me of not understanding this. We have shown that as long as ionic lattice is periodic, right, this does not lead to collisions. Rather, one can find a good eigenstates of electrons in this periodic potential. And as we have argued, electron, in fact, in a lattice has an average velocity that is non-vanishing. So ions actually don't lead to collisions as long as they form a perfectly periodic lattice. So let's just cross that out. However, as soon as they deviate from perfect periodicity, namely as soon as we introduce vibrations or some crystal defects, then those do, and they represent a defect to this perfect periodicity, and they then contribute to these collisions. Now, another remark that I want to make is that electron-electron collisions are typically a weak effect, which can be only observed in, again, very pure samples at very low temperatures, at a kind of ambient conditions, meaning at room temperature in normal metals. It's these two effects that are dominant typically. At high temperatures, phonons dominate. You can lower the temperature, lattice starts vibrate less, and then you can cross over to a regime that is dominated by crystal defects and impurities, and those two balance off when you make the crystal purer. Then you can reduce its resistivity, but then you have to cool it down to lower temperature because phonons always are there. So a large part of traditional condensed matter physics or solid state physics deals with these sources of collisions, and you know, you can develop a detailed theory for how these work and what they actually do. And this is not what we're going to do. We're going to use in our further discussion what is called a relaxation time approximation. So we're going to include collisions through the relaxation time approximation. And the relaxation time approximation simply acknowledges that there are sources of collisions in a solid, but their effect is by and large universal in that they tend to restore equilibrium when you try to push system out of equilibrium, say by applying electric field. They tend to restore equilibrium, and all these sources of collisions have an effect and contribution to this relaxation time mechanism. So what this relaxation time approximation says is the following. It says that electron in a solid experiences a collision in time interval dt with probability dt divided by tau n rk, where tau n rk is the relaxation time. And in principle, it can depend on which band are you in. So it has a band index. It can depend on what momentum the electron has, and it can depend on where in the sample the electron is. Yes?
So wouldn't an impurity usually be an ion? Or no? Like, I don't know what an impurity is. Can you say that it's the dominant effect of collision, or causes collision?
Well, impurity, there's a different kind of, by impurities usually one means either substitutional impurity, so you have a lattice, I don't know, iron metal, and instead of iron atom you have a cadmium or something. That would be a typical impurity. There can be other crystal defects, and these are you know, all sorts of dislocations, disclinations. There's many different types of defect.
But like a collision one, it's not crashing into an ion, like the
ion. Oh, okay. Yeah, so maybe I was not clear. So by ions, I mean a periodic ion lattice, right? The Drude model was basically like this. You have a periodic lattice of ions, and then Drude envisioned that electron as a classical particle would just go around and bounce around these ions, and that's how it would relax. And so what I'm saying is that as long as this ionic lattice is perfectly periodic, this is not a valid mechanism, right? As soon as you have some imperfections in this periodicity, for instance, you displace this ion here, like as in phonon, or you replace it by, you know, double plus ion with different valence or something, in such a way that it breaks the translation invariance, then that leads to a collision. So, okay. So let's write it like this: ion lattice, and let's cross it over. So ion lattice that Drude assumed was the dominant scatterer is not really the right answer. Any other questions?
So, below the semi-classical equations of motion, could you calculate this by introducing some like a linear drag terms?
Can you please speak up? I cannot hear you.
At the level of the equations, semi-classical equations of motion, could this be included like a linear drag term of some kind?
Yes, exactly. So the next step, thank you for that question, the next step now is to construct a theory, and that's the semi-classical theory of conduction in metals, that combines the semi-classical equations of motion that we discussed with this idea of relaxation time approximation. And basically, the way it works, so this is the semi-classical theory of conduction. It works basically like this, and I will just do that pictorially here. Electron moves in a solid, and it follows the semi-classical equations, right? So it moves, and maybe if there is magnetic field, it curves around like it should. And then it undergoes this collision, which basically, if this is a real space trajectory, it changes its momentum and direction like this. So this is a collision. And again, there's another electron that moves and then undergoes a collision and maybe starts going back, right? And the theory that one needs to develop is now the one that takes into account these relaxation processes on top of this semi-classical equation of motion. And this is where it gets technical, and this is the part that I will skip, and I will refer any interested party to Ashcroft and Merman. This is chapter 13, where this is developed in a great detail. But basically, it relies on the following concept. So let me just write that the theory relies on the concept of the non-equilibrium distribution function which is defined as follows. Usually people use GN for this notation. So this GN, which is a function of R, K, and T, times the volume element, is defined as number of electrons in the nth band at time t. And the phase space volume around the point R dot R and K. Now, interestingly, and this is what's done in chapter 13 of Ashcroft and Merman, basically only taking into account the semi-classical equations of motion and this definition of the relaxation time, plus the assumption that when no external fields are applied, this turns into equilibrium Fermi-Dirac distribution function. one can actually calculate this object, okay, or at least write a closed form equation that needs to be solved to find this object, okay? And again, I will not go through that calculation because that would take another whole lecture. It's a kind of very interesting, procedure. Maybe I just outline the basics of this procedure. So what one does, the way one calculates this function, one considers a volume element in this phase space. So this is this point RK at some time t. And then one considers this volume element as it evolves in this phase space following the semi-classical equations of motion to some later time, R prime, K prime, T prime, right? So we know that if there were no collisions, then this volume element, all the electrons that are initially here would find themselves here just following the semi-classical equations of motion. If there were no fields, then they would just stay at the same momenta. But if there are fields, then they evolved in some way. And then for each infinitesimal time, one considers all the electrons that, according to this relaxation time hypothesis, scatter out of this volume element, plus all those that scatter in from all the other volume elements in phase space. And interestingly, so this is the collisions. And interestingly, you can just integrate all these processes and arrive at a relation between this equilibrium, between non-equilibrium function at this time t and some later time t prime, that is governed by some differential equation, which you can then solve under some relatively mild assumptions. Okay, and I will not go through that, but this is the main idea. So let me just give you some results here. And these results are already simplified by several assumptions. So here are the results for Gn, assuming uniform system and weak slowly varying fields. One also assumes that the relaxation time tau n r k is independent of space, which goes back to the assumption that the system is uniform, so I don't put more collisions in one part of the system than the other. And then another important assumption is that it depends, so it's independent of R, and it depends on momentum, but only through the band energy K. And that, because this is a constant of motion in magnetic field, that allows actually solving these equations for G fully. And under these assumptions, one can actually write an explicit expression for this G n of k. It is f of k, which is just the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. And then there's a correction to it that comes because you have applied fields. And it looks like this. It's proportional to this relaxation time. And then one has a first derivative of this Fermi-Dirac distribution function with respect to the energy Vk dotted into minus E plus epsilon k minus mu divided by t times minus the gradient of t. So this is one thing that I didn't mention. we assume a uniform system and weak slowly varying fields and weak gradient of T. So one thing that we want to get out of this is not only electrical, but also thermal conductivity. And for this, we need to put in also a temperature gradient. But without the temperature gradient, it works as well. So this is a kind of interesting achievement of theoretical physics, that one can solve this seemingly intractable problem under these assumptions basically rigorously. And this is sometimes also known as a linear response theory. Okay. It is valid in the presence of non-zero magnetic field, although magnetic fields don't appear here explicitly. If there is magnetic field, then one has to solve for the velocity as function of magnetic field, as we discussed previously. Question?
Which of these assumptions can you relax? I mean, if you have more than slowly varying E and H, then your semi-classical approximation kind of falls apart. Can you relax anything else, like the uniform system?
So you can relax any of these assumptions and then study what happens. But then, in general, you can almost never find a solution of these differential equations in the closed form. So you have to then solve them numerically. Yeah, if the electric and magnetic fields, I mean, they have to still vary slowly enough and be small enough so that the semi-classical description holds. Once you start having electric or magnetic breakdown, then this whole theory falls apart. So this whole theory is most useful under these assumptions. In a lab, you can always limit yourself to weak electric and magnetic fields, and you know that's what people usually do. And then when they crank the fields too high, typically what happens is not that the equations break down, but they fry their sample. So, which is some sort of breakdown, but maybe not of theory, but. Of the actual experiment. It's this last assumption here that, this relaxation time, you can make the sample uniform so that it's roughly independent of space, but the fact that it depends on K, that has no real deep justification. It's simply that in that case, one can integrate these equations and get the closed form. This is a surprisingly good, when you compare the results of this to experiment, this is a surprisingly good approximation, so people continue using it. And there are some studies what happens when you don't make this approximation, and there are some small changes to this. Okay, so let's now just use this and see what it implies for transport coefficients in a material. And this is where I stop. So we have another 10, 15 minutes. Let's do this. So let's write. The thermal current and electrical current. So electrical current looks like this in terms of this non-equilibrium distribution function. And again, it's an obvious definition, but I write it down here. It's sum over all bands integral v3k over 4 pi cubed vnk times gn of k. Okay, so basically previously I wrote a similar expression where it would just look like this. And here I assumed I'm in the ground state, or I just integrate over occupied states, right? So this is the same expression because this function tells me which of those momentum states are occupied, right? So I'm simply integrating over all the velocities of all occupied states in the system and multiplying it by the electron charge that gives me electrical current. And similarly, thermal current, which I denote by JQ, has an expression like this, sum over n integral d3k over 4 pi cubed. And here, instead of charge, I'm summing over the energy of the electron, reference to the chemical potential, Vnk times Gn of k. And the idea is similar. Thermal current is essentially an energy current, so I'm summing over all the energy times the velocity that gives me an energy current per electron, and this just tells me which of these states are occupied. Okay, so now what I'll do, I just take that form of my non-equilibrium distribution function, substitute it in here, and see what I get. First of all, I notice that this first piece, which is just the Fermi-Dirac distribution, that does not give me a contribution to any currents because in equilibrium I don't expect to get currents. It's only the second piece that gives me contributions. Namely, I only expect currents to have when I have applied electric fields or thermal gradients. And the expression that I get looks like this. Electrical current can be related to electric fields and thermal gradients like this. And similarly for the thermal current, these guys, L11, L12, L21, L22, are the so-called thermoelectric tensors, which I will express in a moment. Often people ask why there is always this minus gradient of T, and this is simply because the definition of heat current is that the heat flows from hotter to colder end of a sample, and gradient of T, of course, increases from colder to hotter. So if we want a usual description, usual definition of heat current, then we put a minus gradient of T there. But it's just a convention. And these components of thermoelectric tensor now notice that, I mean, these are four different tensors because relation between J and E, for instance, this does not need to be a constant. This can be a rank three tensor because in a crystal, when you apply electric field in certain direction, the current can flow at a direction that is not necessarily parallel to it. So this is for a three component vector, this should be viewed as a 3x3 matrix. So those four objects are individually tensors, and they can be expressed like this. L11 is L0. L21 can be shown to be equal to L12 times T, and this is equal to minus 1 over E times L1, and I will define these curly L's in a moment, and L22 is 1 over e squared t. This should be a regular L. times L2, where this L of alpha is just a simple expression like this. It's E squared D3K over 4 pi cubed minus DF over the epsilon tau of epsilon K V K V K epsilon K minus mu to power alpha. So I define three objects like this with different powers of alpha here, 0, 1, and 2. And they four tensors depend on these three objects like so. And you can see that that's sensible when I substitute that in. That's what I expect because I have one power of this energy minus mu in this definition. So I pick up additional powers from there up to power 2. And yeah, it's just a simple algebra that shows that. Also note that this is not an inner product. This is an outer product here. In other words, this carries two Cartesian indices. I can write it as ij, and then I would put ij here. So for instance, LXX would have two x components and so on. So it's a tensor. Okay, any questions about this? So there's two simple results that maybe I can, if not derive, then I can outline them quickly. For a metal at low T and gradient T equals 0, we can obtain from here electrical conductivity and you can see from these equations, if I don't apply any thermal gradient, then I just have J is equal to L11 times E. So I just have to calculate L11, which is this L at zero. So I here don't have any powers of this energy. And then I just have to calculate an integral of derivative of a Fermi function times the relaxation time times this outer product of velocities, and what I then obtain is that J is equal to sigma times E, where sigma is just a conductivity, and for sigma, I can write from this equation E squared, and if I just want to calculate it approximately, I assume that this relaxation rate is roughly constant, so I evaluate it at the Fermi energy, and then I integrate d3k over 4 pi cubed. And one thing that I can do, I can manipulate this expression as follows. I can write it as d v of k dk times epsilon f of epsilon k. So I have integrated by parts and then rewrote derivative with respect to epsilon to derivative with respect to v, and you can check that this is in fact an identity, and derivative of a velocity with respect to k, this is roughly just h-bar over mass. If I pull that out and integrate the Fermi-Dirac distribution over the volume of the Brillouin zone, then that just gives me the total occupancy of electrons. So when I put everything together, I get n e squared. This is effective mass, tau divided by m star. And this is nothing but the Drude formula. This is, pardon me? Am I missing something? Yeah, I'm missing an H bar here. This is one reason why this theory of transport is somewhat disappointing, especially when you invest an extra lecture to actually derive these equations. And then in the end, you just recover the Drude formula that you can get from elementary considerations at the very beginning of the course. Now, of course, this expression here and those expressions derived there have vastly more validity than the simple Drude model, which is a kind of classical model. It tells you about where they fail and so on. You can calculate the thermal conductivity as well. Are there any questions? So let me just, I ran out of space again. So let me just mention one more result and then I stop, which is related to the thermal conductivity. Namely, under those same conditions, namely when you're at low temperature and you assume that the relaxation time is not a strong function of energy, so that you can pull it out of the integral with the value near the Fermi energy where this function peaks, you can actually calculate the thermal conductivity as well. And what you find, so let me continue here. For thermal conductivity, kappa, which is defined as a relation JQ is equal to kappa times minus gradient T under the condition that there is no electrical currents flowing in the system, you find that this kappa is actually related to sigma by the following very simple relation. Kappa is equal to pi squared over 3 kb over e squared t times sigma. And this goes under the name of Wiedemann Franz law. And this has been discovered experimentally long, long time before all this theory was developed. Experimentally, it is known that in all metals, thermal conductivity is proportional to electrical conductivity. Notice the constant of proportionality, aside from temperature, just contains universal constants, pi, Boltzmann constant, and charge of electrons. So this is a kind of profound result that is satisfied to a very good accuracy in all metals. This is violated in semiconductors and insulators. It's also violated in a superconductor, but in all metals, this is very well satisfied. This is all about transport theory. We did it. And next week, we move into 21st century. We do some interesting things. Thank you very much. And I see you tomorrow or Monday. Have a nice weekend.